We're exploring research on white-tailed deer encountering the coronavirus on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. USDA researchers, they analyzed blood samples from close to 500 deer in neighboring states Illinois and Michigan, along with deer from New York and Pennsylvania. The Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service published its findings this month in a two-page Q&A-style format, and it led us to further questions. Let's hear yours, too. Do you worry that the coronavirus might continue to mutate if it spreads to wild animals? Do you hunt? What questions do you have about your risk of a coronavirus hybrid from deer? 800-642-1234 to join in. Kristen Bernard is a professor of veterinary virology in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She is an expert on zoonotic viruses transmitted between animals and people. Kristen, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
What do you make of this study?
Well, I was quite surprised, to be honest. Very, very surprised that there is evidence. Remember, it's just antibodies now. It's no evidence of the actual virus in some wild deer.
Yeah, you know, what could that mean if you do find the antibodies in this blood serum? Where could they be coming from?
Well, they definitely would have to be exposed to the virus itself or to the actual SARS coronavirus, or to a related virus to be able to develop those antibodies. But it is possible that it is a related virus and not the actual SARS coronavirus.
Yeah, and that's an important distinction because the deer did not test positive for the coronavirus, but their blood contained antibodies for the virus. Can you explain what that difference is?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's almost like a footprint in your immune system, if you want to think about it that way, where when we're exposed to any kind of a pathogen or even allergies, foreign proteins of any kind, viruses, bacteria, etc., our immune system develops antibodies to it as well as other molecules, but in particular, it's those antibodies. And they can last for a very, very long time. And that's one of the things we're looking at with the vaccines currently, is how long do the antibodies last in people that get the vaccines. So those antibodies are often protective against the pathogen, and so that when you're exposed again, the antibodies are right there in your blood ready to attack the pathogen. So in this case, it's possible that they were exposed to the particular SARS coronavirus or a related one.
Well, it's interesting that you describe it as a footprint because, you know, that's unique to each individual person. Would that be the case with these deer?
Well, the antibodies are unique in our populations. All of us usually develop slightly different ones, mm-hmm. although there are particular areas of the pathogen, in this case the virus, that are typical for all of us individuals to react to. So they actually often are very, very similar in that they bind at the same place, but then our whole repertoire of antibodies might be binding to different parts of the virus.
So
that makes sense. It's a little complicated.
No, I'm following here. Is it possible that the deer could have these antibodies without having been exposed to the virus, SARS-CoV-2?
It's possible if they were exposed to a related virus.
Okay.
And the other thing that was interesting about this particular study is they looked at serum from deer that were before the pandemic, and they didn't have the antibodies. I mean, of course, they're not the same deer, but from samples that they had stored in the freezer, they did not have any antibodies before the pandemic, which makes you think, okay, maybe they were exposed to the SARS coronavirus.
So this research is in the early stages. What more do you, as a researcher, as a scientist, need to know before drawing any conclusions about what you're seeing here?
Yeah, well, first of all, it isn't peer-reviewed yet, this particular paper. It's, I'm sure, out for review now, so I'm interested in seeing the paper once it's peer-reviewed. And there, what I want to see is, did they look at a panel of coronaviruses, not just SARS coronavirus, but perhaps those coronaviruses that infect cattle that I don't know that we have one that we've isolated that infects deer yet. I'm sure they have one. But looking at a panel of viruses, so just in this particular study, I'd like to see that. Another group at USDA, and actually maybe some of the same investigators, did do an experimental infection in deer and that is published. And so there they actually exposed some young deer to in the laboratory setting to the coronavirus, and they did get sick and they were able to transmit it. So that does also give us more evidence that this may be a true transmission of SARS coronavirus to the deer in the wild. So I'd like to then see after that, looking at other deer populations and being sure, looking at other coronaviruses to see if the deer's antibodies will bind to those other coronaviruses.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Kristen Bernard, who is a professor in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, as we discuss how deer may have been exposed to the coronavirus in this new USDA study. With your questions along the way, what do you want to know about how viruses mutate, how they evolve? What about the questions you have about the potential of your pets catching a variant of the coronavirus? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Kristen, if the coronavirus is in fact circulating among white-tailed deer, are there any indications of how they might have contracted it?
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest puzzles especially for me. Where would they have gotten enough exposure to a human to become infected? That seems really remote, possible, but very remote possibility in my mind. It's also possible that maybe another animal became infected that has closer contact with people, and then that particular animal transmitted to the deer. We have no idea. Those are other studies that should be ongoing as more in-field studies to determine if there are other animals that are exposed and can spread the virus amongst themselves and to other species. So that's another research area that we really need more information on.
And, you know, hunting season's so big in Wisconsin here.
Yeah, definitely.
What did the USDA say about people and, you know, with the possibility of catching the coronavirus from a wild deer?
Yeah, I think right now we are more concerned with being catching the virus from each other.
Each other.
Right. But it's always possible, as you mentioned, that there could be some mutations happening in the deer that would make this virus different than the one that we're currently circulating in the humans. But as far as catching it from eating deer meat,
like cooking and eating venison. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. Then that would definitely not be an issue because the virus is killed upon cooking.
So which animals could be susceptible to the coronavirus and could be carriers? I mean, we've heard about the mink outbreak. Are there animals that are more susceptible?
Yeah, great question. Any of the animals in the mink family, which is the mustelids, so minks and ferrets, weasels, those animals appear to be more susceptible that we've noticed in the laboratory, as well as, of course, in those mink outbreaks that you mentioned in the mink farms. And then felids do seem to be more susceptible. Some of the domestic cats have become infected. It's a rare occasion, but they have been. And some of our zoo cats as well, lions and tigers, have become infected. So it appears that both the felids and the mustelids are more susceptible to the virus. Now, whether or not they'll really start a transmission cycle and, you know, have that virus forever in their population, we don't have enough evidence for that yet.
Have there been animal vaccinations, that COVID vaccinations that you've been watching?
Yes, there has been. Some of the zoo animals are becoming being vaccinated by the zoo veterinarians. In particular, they're protecting the great apes as well as those large felines, so the tigers and lions.
We're talking with UW-Madison virologist Kristen Bernard, helping us unpack research from the USDA on blood specimens collected from white-tailed deer in multiple states having a coronavirus antibodies. What do you want to know about how viruses can pass back and forth between humans and animals? What questions do you have about how viruses mutate, how they evolve? Join in any point here, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. A new USDA study out has found one-third of deer tested in their hundreds of samples had coronavirus antibodies. We're discussing implications with a zoonotic disease researcher who was not involved in this study here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The researchers used blood samples from white-tailed deer in multiple states before and after the pandemic started, revealing exposure to the virus in an animal population. Do you hunt? Do you worry that the coronavirus might continue to mutate if it spreads to wild animals? 800-642-1234. Kristen Bernard from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine studies vector-borne illnesses and with us for about nine more minutes. Let's take a call now. Taran is joining us from TOMA. Hi, Taran.
Hi. So I have a concern with a petting zoo in the Wisconsin Dells. You know what? This zoo, they have a lot of white-tailed deer, and they also have some goats and rams that families can come and pay to feed and pet and play with. So I'm wondering if you think that this will be a major cause for a big spreading for not only Wisconsinites, but for a lot of out-of-state tourists that might come over.
Petting zoos, Kristen.
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think at this point in time, we really don't have any idea if those animals can spread it to people. And I think our biggest risk still is human-to-human transmission. So I don't find that it, in especially outside in the environment, as long as the people, I would recommend everybody wearing masks if you're in close contact, even outside. And as long as people wash their hands afterwards, and usually those petting zoo type environments have really good hand washing sinks. Mm-hmm. And that would be the most important thing. Now, going forward in the future, if we find more research that other animals can become infected and we start to control it in our own human population, then we might have more concern.
Let's bring in Andrew now in Palmyra. Andrew, hi, go ahead.
Hi there. I just had a quick question about how viruses that occur generally in one species could be transmitted to another. It seems odd to me to have that jump from one to another because, for instance, dogs, they get certain shots, they take certain medications like, heartworm chews and things like that the humans don't have to take. So I'm just wondering, is that transmission, is that something that would occur naturally, or does that take some manipulating behind the scenes for that to occur?
Andrew, thank you. On the spillover effect, Kristen.
Yeah, thank you for that question. Actually, it depends on the pathogen, and my students hate it when I say it depends. but a lot of pathogens will transmit between humans and animals and back and forth. Many, many, many do that. And it depends on whether or not the virus has really, and I'm going to talk about viruses now, whether or not the virus really has specific interactions with a protein or other components of a person's cell that only humans have. And then they will not be able to infect animals well, or vice versa. But there are a lot of viruses. Influenza virus is a classic one that we know can infect birds and pigs and people, and they go back and forth all the time, and we have lots of evidence for that. So that's a natural transmission. And we've seen this before with coronaviruses. And in fact, the very first SARS we know came from an animal. We don't know exactly which one. And then the MERS coronavirus, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus, actually is transmitted from camels to people. So we know this happens naturally, and it happens with a lot of different viruses. But you are right. There are some pathogens that are specific for specific animal species. Your dogs get it vaccinated against parvovirus, and it's a canine parvovirus. Humans can't get that, fortunately. So there, it does depend on the particular pathogen we're talking about.
I want to pick up on what you said there, because there remain different theories about where the virus originated. Some scientists continue to speculate that it could have been unleashed inadvertently through a research lab in Wuhan. And then other researchers think, as you mentioned, it had, you know, passed from a wild animal like a bat or a pangolin. What is known now about where the virus originated from?
Yeah, probably not a lot more information than what you just said, Kate. We still, I would say, vast majority of virologists believe that it was from an animal species. It's really hard to absolutely rule out that it didn't come from a laboratory. It's proving the negative. It's very difficult. And I do believe that the Chinese scientists are showing their records, and WHO went and looked at those records, and they didn't have any evidence of a scientist becoming sick and then infecting the population, which is the way I would think it could have happened if it was going to. So I would say the vast majority of us believe that it's coming from an animal species. But until we find that particular virus in an animal species, we have the relatives, the distant relatives in animal species. Until we actually find it, it's hard to be definitive.
Is that like finding a needle in a haystack? How difficult will it?
Yes, it definitely is.
I mean, because that will then help you make a definitive origin point as to trace where the virus came from?
Yes. And that would be helpful, because then we can say, oh, all right, yes, the relatives are in bats, but perhaps it was some other animal species in between. And those are the ones that we need to be more careful not to have contact with as humans.
We're talking with UW-Madison Professor Kristen Bernard, who is an expert on zoonotic viruses transmitted between animals and people, as we look at new findings out from the USDA on coronavirus antibodies found in hundreds of deer samples. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Kristen, you touched on this earlier about vaccinating animals, and we know mink farmers are vaccinating their animals against the virus. Is it possible to vaccinate wildlife?
Oh, that's a good question. There's actually one of our faculty in my department, Jorge Osorio, does quite a bit of work on developing new vaccines for wildlife. And it's obviously very difficult. Usually you're going to want to have something that an animal can eat and then become vaccinated, because you can put out baits. And in fact, especially in the Northeast, they were using baits to try to control rabies virus in raccoons. And so they would actually spread out, and I'm not sure if they're still doing it, but a good 10 years ago they were. They spread out these baits using planes and flying over the Adirondack Mountains.
How did that work out for them?
And you know raccoons, they love to eat stuff, right? So they would find the baits and eat and actually become vaccinated. But it is difficult. We thought about trying to vaccinate birds against West Nile virus. It's not an easy task. Dr. Osorio is looking at prairie dogs and vaccinating them against the plague. So there's different methods, but it is very difficult.
Quickly here, John from Boaz called in to tell us that animals like dogs can also help us by sharing good bacteria with us. Any insights there on good bacteria?
On good bacteria? Well, I mean, having a good, what we call a microbiome now, in the last 5 or 6 years, we always talk about our microbiome and having the good probiotics, et cetera. Mm. So I think being exposed to the whole bacterial field is always useful. Now, of course, most of us humans have our microbiome and it's not affected too much by other animals, but you know, it doesn't hurt to have a nice, healthy microbiome.
And as we wrap up here, what big questions do you need to understand about the coronavirus that you're really hoping to get answered pretty soon?
Let's see. I guess one question would be, which I now understand CDC is recommending putting out, having another booster shot. Mm-hmm. So I think the longevity of our immune response for the vaccine is a big question. And the other question is the longevity of the immune response after a natural infection. And why do we tend to get infected again, even after a natural exposure to SARS coronavirus?
Kristen, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Kristen Bernard is professor of veterinary virology at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She's an expert on zoonotic viruses. Coming up, we check in with the state epidemiologist for community health and pediatrician, Dr. Jasmine Zapata. That's after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about kids and COVID on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the CDC COVID tracker, pediatric hospitalizations for the virus have been rising rapidly. But according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, more than 500,000 children received the first COVID vaccine dose this past week. What's on your mind about sending your child back to the classroom as the Delta variant spreads widely? Is your tween on the cusp of turning 12? What have you talked about in terms of getting vaccinated? What questions do you have for the pediatrician? 800-642-1234. Dr. Jasmine Zapata is Chief Medical Officer and State Epidemiologist for Community Health for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, DHS, and she specializes in pediatrics and preventative medicine. Dr. Zapata, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much.
More children are getting infected now, being hospitalized. And with the Delta variant, are children now at greater risk than they were last year?
Great question. We are definitely seeing that Delta is different. Mm-hmm. We are living in different times than we were last year. It's a very different situation. We know that Delta variant has much higher transmission rates, where it can spread much easier. And that is definitely impacting our children. And we're definitely seeing more children hospitalized and getting sick with this variant than last year. So this is a very serious situation.
What are you telling parents?
Yes. My personal approach is to have a conversation with parents. A lot of times we talk about educating and telling people things. My biggest approach and the approach at Wisconsin Department of Health Services is really continuing conversations. Personally, what I like to do is just listen, take some time to listen for the first several minutes to just hear what's on the parents' hearts, what their concerns are, what their experience has been, and then validate their concerns and then have a conversation, give a few facts and figures and help them think through what is the best choice for their children. But ultimately, my main message that I tell them is that the vaccines are safe and effective. And one of the best things that we can do to protect our children once they are of an eligible age is to get the vaccine.
I'm sure you're watching, you know, schools across the country have started. And here in Wisconsin, we're about 2 weeks out from first day. Do you think in-person schooling for unvaccinated children is safe?
That is a great question. Personally, when I've been talking to my personal network of friends and family, talk to other colleagues and schools, I acknowledge the fact that everything that we do is taking a risk, and we must weigh the risks and benefits for every choice that we are making. So on one hand, when you think about it, to be extremely cautious and safe from any infectious disease. If you just imagine yourself sitting in the house, never leaving for food or groceries or to go anywhere, and you just sit in your house for the whole entire year, you'll be pretty safe compared to when you go out. Mm. However, what are the emotional implications of that? So when you think about children going back to school, it is safe when you just sit at home and they're doing that virtual schooling because they're not exposed to others. However, when you talk about safety, do you mean physical safety, or are we also talking about emotional and mental health and safety in that way? Yeah. So we know that there are some very serious implications of taking children away from that social environment. But on one hand, sending them to school, that it will help with their education, help with that social environment. But anytime you leave out the house, whether it's school, to the grocery store, even to a large gathering or going outdoors, then you are slightly increasing your risk just anytime you're leaving the house.
And it's like we as parents, I just feel like we're having to make these micro mini decisions every day about determining risk. Like, should we be holding our children back from social activities and then balancing, as you said, that social emotional learning? And what about birthday parties? What about joining the soccer team? There are so many questions, Dr. Zapata.
Yes, yes. This is not easy. I'm not going to come and say like, oh, here's the exact thing to do, or this is such an easy time. It's definitely difficult. I myself am a parent of a fresh 12-year-old and almost 11-year-old and a 3-year-old. So these are constant conversations in our house and in our families. It's not easy. Back to the question about schools. For parents that do decide to send your children to school, one of the safest things that we know that we can do is continuing to have children practice good hand washing at schools, physical distancing, and then also wearing a mask, especially if they're not of the age to get vaccinated yet. Wearing masks in schools is effective, and that's one of the things we can do to keep our children safe.
When you talk to little ones about mask wearing, what are some of the messages you have for your kids in wearing masks correctly, but also not like trying to overcorrect, you know, all the time, like your mask isn't on straight, get your mask on correctly. You know, what do you say?
Yes, I love to play games with my children, make it fun, watch videos or little jingles about keeping your mask on and just trying not to instill too much fear in them, but just gently correcting them as they're doing it and being a good example myself.
When do you think children under 12 will be approved for the vaccine?
That is an amazing question. That is the million-dollar question. There's a lot still going on with that. The different companies that are doing research and institutions that are doing research on the vaccination in children under 12 recently decided to increase the number of children enrolled in their study just so they can get even more robust data. So that delayed it a little bit. However, I am hoping it will be approved in the next few months. Several medical experts are anticipating it could even be approved before the end of the year, for sure, early 2022. So I'm anticipating it is likely to happen within this school year sooner than we think. And that's why it's so important to have these conversations and be thinking about this and talking to people. If you are a parent, begin thinking about this because it can happen sooner than you know. And so it's important to get your thoughts together and start thinking about the decision that you're going to make.
You know, just a logistical question here with kids on the cusp of turning 12. I have one of those in a few days. But when you call the pediatrician and you want to schedule that COVID vaccine, it's like, no, you got to call back when they are 12 and then you can schedule. What are the logistics there of getting that child in to get vaccinated?
Well, I'm sorry that happened to you. Every single clinic and it has a different workflow. But the great thing is that there are so many places that you can get your children vaccinated, even if it's not their primary care clinic. There are still many, many community vaccination sites and pharmacies and other locations. So if you go to vaccines.gov, that's great because you can just put in where you are located and they can help you find many different options. So if there is a location you're trying to get into that you're finding any difficulty, just remember there's a lot of places that you can get the vaccine or get an appointment. So sorry that happened.
No, that's right. Yeah. So you're saying that places that serve adults with the vaccine may also serve children?
Yes, large majority of them do. They will, most all locations right now that are doing community vaccine clinics or even at the workplace, there's many vaccine clinics on site at the workplace that say you can bring yourself or your family and children mm-hmm. over 12 and they have the Pfizer vaccine. So yes, definitely.
We're talking with Dr. Jasmine Zapata, Chief Medical Officer, State Epidemiologist for Community Health at Wisconsin DHS, getting at the latest on the Delta variant, kids, COVID, your questions, 800-642-1234. Paula is joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Paula. What is on your mind?
Oh, hi. Yeah. Can the doctor please dispel? I know this is misinformation, but it's out there on the internet. Regarding fertility / reproductive concerns in young teen girls getting the vaccination, because that is out there circulating.
Paula, thank you.
Yes, thanks for being here with us this morning and calling in. There is no strong evidence at all to report that it causes any issues with fertility. There have been many studies looking into that, and there's no strong evidence that shows that there's any problems with that from what we know right now. One of the ways, now this is me personally, one of the ways that I think about it, because I actually have a young daughter who's getting ready to be 11, and so within a year, she'll be eligible for the vaccine if it's for 12 and up, but if 12 and under gets approved, she'll be eligible earlier, and I'm having her get it. Now, one thing that I think about is I weigh risks and benefits for anything. We've just been talking about parents have to make such tough decisions. And I think about it as, you know, even if there were some small risk, which we have seen that there is not, even if there was some small risk related to fertility, well, I want my daughter to reach the age of having children in the future. I want her to live to see that day. Delta variant and COVID is a serious and real risk to our children. There are about 400 children who have died from COVID-19 in the United States. Now, many people say, out of all the people nationwide who have died, only 400 children. But what if that child was yours? What if that one child was yours? That's devastating. And so one child is too many. So I want my daughter to live to even get into her 20s, 30s, or whenever she's going to start having children. I want her to even get to that point. So you have to weigh the risk and the benefits. From what we have seen, there is no impact on fertility, and it is safe and effective to get your children vaccinated.
Dr. Zapata, I want to touch on booster shots here because there's some early information coming out this morning that the Biden administration will direct most Americans to get a COVID booster vaccination 8 months after they receive their second dose. New York Times is reporting the announcement could come as early as this week. What do you see by way of who needs a booster shot and how you approach booster shots?
Great question. So we know that when you get the vaccine or even get COVID naturally, you have some level of protection. You have more robust protection from COVID-19 when you get the vaccine. But over time, and that's what there's active research right now as we speak, active research into that. But what we're seeing, and medical experts and scientists are starting to look into and see, is there is a possibility that some of that protection might slowly wear off slowly over time. The key question is, how long does that protection last? And when is the right timing to potentially get a booster shot? So right now, some studies are showing about 8 months. And so that's why the recommendations, the pending recommendations are suggesting possibly getting a booster around 8 months after you've gotten your last shot. And so there's still a lot of research going on about it, but I do anticipate that that announcement might be coming out soon. As far as priority for who gets that booster shot, right now, the priority is for individuals who are immunocompromised, that for whatever reason, whether they have an underlying condition or they're on some sort of medication that suppresses their immune system, they are at a higher risk of getting COVID and getting severely ill from it. So those who are immunocompromised would be the first priority.
First people in line. Let's pause right there with pediatrician Jasmine Zapata, state epidemiologist for community health at DHS, fielding your questions about COVID, the Delta variant. Do you have a child who's 12 or older but hasn't gotten the vaccine yet? What do you want to ask? What do you want to know about the Delta strain specifically and its effect? What questions do you have about your child's mask, about safety protocols in schools? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with physician Jasmine Zapata here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The number of COVID cases in children has steadily increased since the beginning of July. That's analysis from the American Academy of Pediatrics. The AAP says of last Thursday, more than 4.4 million children have tested positive for COVID since the onset of the pandemic. We're getting at your questions, 800-642-1234. Dr. Jasmine Zapata is a pediatrician and state epidemiologist for community health at DHS with us for about 8 more minutes. Dr. Zapata, you were saying that last week the FDA authorized those third doses of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines for people with weakened immune systems. What should we know about booster shots, especially for this segment of the population that is immunocompromised, and then boosters for what populations after that?
That is a great question. Those determinations are being developed right now as we speak. There's some suggestions that the next group will be those over the age of 65, because we know that they have had higher hospitalization and death rates. The next suggested group for booster doses, there is some conversation that it may be healthcare workers, almost the same order that it went in at when the booster shots first rolled out. I'm sorry, when the vaccines first rolled out. Uh-huh. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are your thoughts on the CDC urging vaccines for people who are pregnant, especially in response to the Delta variant?
Yes, that's a great question. And in fact, personally, my inbox is always lighting up with a lot of my pregnant friends and family members. It's always asking me, and this is a very serious conversation to have, because when you're a pregnant person, you are concerned not only about yourself, but the baby that you are carrying. We know that in pregnant people, vaccines are safe and effective. Any small risks definitely do not outweigh the benefits of getting the vaccine. The recent study that was completed showed that the vaccines were safe and effective in pregnant people and those who are breastfeeding. And we actually see evidence that if pregnant people get COVID-19, there are increased rates of complications and even premature birth. Mm. Now, my daughter was born a premature birth about 11 years ago. She was only 1.5 pounds, and our family is still healing from the consequences of her being born so early and so soon. So there are real risks if pregnant people get COVID-19. We know that. And we know that the vaccines are safe and effective. So we definitely are recommending those for pregnant people.
There are 660 hospitalized COVID patients now from the Wisconsin Hospital Association there. And there were under 100 COVID patients at the beginning of July in hospitals. We see these numbers inching up by the day. You know, we're still well under what hospitalizations were in the thousands last November. But what concerns do you have about hospitals, healthcare teams meeting this surge, especially with the children?
This is a very serious concern for me, especially looking at what is happening in Florida. And I am in communication personally with colleagues, my physician and hospital colleagues from across the nation. There is a lot of concern. Just imagine if you have a heart attack and you want to rush into the hospital, but then you're told you can't come to your local hospital. We need to transport you an hour away because all the hospital beds and ICU beds are full with COVID patients. That is what's happening. There are some hospitals where all of the ICU beds for even children are filled. So you have to wait till either a child recovers or dies before your child can get in. There is a lot of concern going on. And what concerns me is that the trends that we're seeing in Florida, there's anticipation that that same trends will come to Wisconsin. And why is that? And this is a key point I just want to leave everyone with before we end for today. In Florida versus Wisconsin, we have about the same vaccination rates. And look at what is happening in Florida. They're having a surge, beds are full, they're having a lack of hospital doctors even to handle what's going on. Florida is extremely hot during the summer. So what does everyone do? They spend more time indoors. Wisconsin right now, we are all spending a lot of time outdoors, but as we creep into these colder months, everyone's going to be coming in. And so there's anticipation that we're going to see something similar to Florida. And that is why we are doing everything that we can to plead with people, please get the vaccine. Please, if you don't trust it or you have questions, continue having conversations with people that you do trust. We don't want to lose anyone else. We want to protect our children. We want everyone to live their best lives. So those are some of my concerns, but that's why we're out here at 7:30 in the morning having these conversations on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Dr. Zapata, when you last joined us back in May, there were some 46% of the state had gotten at least their first dose of the vaccine. Now we sit at about 53% having gotten the first shot. How I can hear your voice with all of the urgency, but how do you get those vaccination rates up?
We just keep having conversations and showing love. That's personally one of the things that I've been really focusing on. This conversation can be very polarizing at times, and sometimes there are those who have made the decision not to get the vaccine who feel isolated or a lot of stigma, and that's only going to push people away further. So keep having conversations until people feel more comfortable, and that's what we're here doing. Some people are able to make that decision right away. Some people need a little bit more time. I'll be honest and very transparent. Even though I'm a medical doctor and a public health leader, I've had my own negative experiences as just being honest as a Black woman dealing with the healthcare system and my family as well. So when the vaccine initially came out, I did have a little initial hesitance and I wanted to just do my research and kind of wait a little bit. So, I got vaccinated ultimately, but I just needed a little bit of time. This is something that our nation and our world has not dealt with in over 100 years. So it's understandable to have some questions, but we're right here for when you are ready to continue the conversation.
Well, Dr. Zapata, thank you for your work. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Jasmine Zapata, Chief Medical Officer and State Epidemiologist for Community Health at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Stay with us for our next installment of our ongoing Ask the Contractor series, this one focusing on all things electrical around your home. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.